Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. I am just blown away with the book, a new book that's come out. I've got the author with me. The book is called Mighty Bad Land. Bruce Lyendyke is here. He's the author, geologist, and the namesake of Antarctica's Mount Lyendyke. So I'm speaking with a man about an expedition in which a mountain in Antarctica was named after this geologist. And we're going to do a little background before I introduce Bruce to the show. He is a professor emeritus from our UC Santa Barbara, a fellow of the Geological Society of America, the American Geophysical Union, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. In addition, in 2016, the U.S. Board on Geographic Names honored the author by naming Summit 1070 in Antarctica Mount Lyendyke. His prior research is in marine geophysics, including the exploration of deep sea black smokers, i.e. hydrothermal vents, using the deep submersible Alvin. You know, that's that interesting little submarine off western Mexico. For this, he and his colleagues shared the Newcomb Cleveland Prize of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Now, what's so interesting to me is that, you know, I've written a couple of books, and I've played with both fiction and nonfiction. I've written both kind of books. And I was launched into this book thinking this is going to be kind of a dry read, very technical, because it comes from a distinguished professor of science. And I was blown away, Bruce, because the idea is that you are such a good narrative writer. I mean, it's hard to do. Now, let me explain to your listeners. It's hard to explain something when you're not explaining it, when you're letting the characters explain. So you're embodying the character and you're saying, okay, you know, my friend said X and I responded X. And therefore you get the narrative down. And so I give you a little example of this in the book, and then I want Bruce to tell us a little bit about how he wrote this book. On page 250, this letter has been delayed for 1 year because of difficulties in transportation at Little America. So what Bruce has done is really excel in dialogue. So this is the topic, but now here we are going to find out what this means through two characters. Delayed a year? Why? Well, before letters could leave Antarctica, the expedition would cancel, postmark them Little America. That's what the American public wanted. Bird Atlantic postmarks were souvenirs. The guy assigned to cancel the letters didn't postmark most of them. There were tens of thousands of letters English brought with them from the first U.S. The uncanceled letters missed return of the ship north in February of 1934. Why didn't he cancel them? Well, way too many for one guy, and he had a nervous breakdown from the workload and tough working conditions. They lived under the surface of the snow, and they were in total darkness in the winter. I thought about how grim that would be. I would have gone crazy. And it goes on and on, the dialogue. And through the dialogue, we learn that letters sent to Antarctica sometimes were sent there for just the postmark and sometimes never really got to the recipient. If the recipient died within a year, forget about it. So it's very interesting. I was thrilled to see how the book unfolded through narrative. And that's just, I mean, I was really impressed, Bruce. So can you give us a little background, just at the top of the interview, give us a little background about how you wrote it, what the time period was that the expedition happened, and why you wrote it when you did. And of course, it's been 30 years from the time of the expedition. So I'd be interested to know what was brewing in your head those 30 years? Anyway, take it from here, Bruce. Tell me a little bit more about Mighty Bad Land and its nomenclature, Marie Bird Land, how the words formed in your mind, the title.
There's a couple of good books about that, but he was the first person to mount a major expedition that actually first saw and discovered what we now call as Marie Bird Land, which is that stretch of Antarctica which borders the South Pacific Ocean. So if you went to Hawaii on a map and you could look due south from there, you'd see at the bottom of the world, you'd see Marie Bird Land in Antarctica. And so how was that named? Obviously, he must be a relative, Marie Bird. It's his wife. He explorers often in those days named things after famous people. He was had a lot of sponsors for his expedition, mainly from the New York establishment. But he was closest to his wife. That was one person he was close to. So on an aerial flight, he was the first to bring airplanes to Antarctica. They first saw for the first time these ranges of mountains. And then when he had a radio interview, actually, with the New York Times, he announced he was naming it Marie Bird Land. Now, what is Mighty Bad Land? Once during the middle and later parts of the 20th century, when outfits like mine started exploring in Marie Bird Land and encountering some of the conditions there and how extreme they were, it became a nickname. It's whimsical, but at the same time, it has real meaning to it. It can get mighty bad in Marie Bird Land, so Mighty Bad Land. And I first heard it when my sponsor at the National Science Foundation told me, well, he asked me a question. He says, well, we're going to fund you. We're going to give you the money to go out and do this project. But are you sure you're up for this? You know, you're going to be out there, just the six of you, and there's you're 800 miles out. That's way beyond helicopter range. We're not going to come jump out and rescue you, so you better be ready for this. So, of course, my stomach, I'm on the phone with him, my stomach sunk a little bit hearing that conversation. And then he says, you know, Marie Bird Land has a nickname. Have you heard it? Before I answered, no. He says, Mighty Bad Land. And so that was the kickoff of how I was thinking about Marie Bird Land. Now, you asked, there's a long intro to the questions you asked was how I wrote the book and why did I wait so long? Well, I waited so long for a couple of reasons. First of all, I was working 110% of my time out at UC Santa Barbara teaching and research, so it wasn't the spare time. And the second thing, which actually is a little bit more important, is even though I thought about Antarctica every day and my multiple expeditions I went there, I really didn't know what the impact was on me of the experience. It was kind of a digesting experience of figuring, what was this? What happened to me? And what did I learn from it? And I can tell you about that eventually. But so, you know, being a professor and liking to talk and profess, I figured, well, I'll just write a book about it. Oh, yeah? So I started taking classes at adult ed here at City College with Shelley Lowenkopf, who's a very well-known local writer. It was a class on personal histories, in other words, memoirs, and also with Tony Lopopo, who's another teacher in the area. And I soon learned very quickly how little I knew about how to write, at least to write for people, as opposed to scientists. And as you said, I just mentioned this a few minutes ago, that when you're telling a story, one of the big differences between writing a story for a research paper versus for people who want to read something of interest is you don't use the passive voice to start with. You use the active voice. I did this instead of the experiments were done, for example. And also, the story is told through scenes that have action and dialogue in them. So like Elmore Leonard once said, nobody skips dialogue. So once you start putting dialogue into a text, people are reading it and people are engaged in it. But it took me, I would say, I took classes with Shelley for, I think it was 4 years. And in the time I was developing different sections of the book, I took workshops with Tony. I went to the Santa Barbara Writers Conference and other conferences. I entered contests. And that took years. And, of course, I thought I had finished my book, right? Well, I think I finished it probably 25 times. So anyway, during the process, I did get an agent and a professional editor who also helped me. And it was a process of many years to actually sell the book. So sorry to take up all that airtime, but that's the answer to your questions.
Well, I'm glad that you elaborated. I wasn't prepared for the professionalism of the writing, and now I know. I've had Tony on the air, and I know he is an expert at dialogue, and that kind of answers that question. And it also answers why you waited 30 years to write the book. You're a person that likes to prepare. And I want to just, before we go to quick break, I want to just, if you're tuning in right now, I want you to know that we're speaking with Santa Barbara's polar explorer and scientist, Bruce Lyandike. His new memoir, Mighty Bad Land, is subtitled A Perilous Expedition to Antarctica. And the clues revealed that found an eighth continent. This is the first expedition to Marie Byrd Land in Antarctica. He went there with a team of six about 30 years ago, 800 miles from the next outpost. So way far up, way far away from anything. A lot of surprises during the expedition. People falling through the snow. I mean, you know, you're just going through the book and seeing all of the adventures and the life-threatening encounters that Bruce went through. Very, very stunning. And I recommend the book heartily. Mighty Bad Land is the title. And Bruce, just very quickly, can you tell us where we can pick the book up, and then we'll go to quick break?
Well, sure. It's releasing on May 30th, next week, and it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And also there's going to be a signing of the book at Chaucer's in Loreto Plaza. They're going to have copies on hand for you to purchase, and I'll sign them. And that's happening this Wednesday. Not this Wednesday, June 7th, Wednesday, a week from this coming Wednesday.
Very good. So, Richard, let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I've got a few more questions. For example, some nuts and bolts questions about sleeping, eating, dressing in Antarctica. I want to know how that was done. I want to know the temperature inside the tent. I want to know some of those real interesting, just curious, I guess. Bruce Lyandike is here with us talking about his book, Mighty Bad Land. Richard, let's go to quick break. It's Elizabeth Stern, and I'm talking with Bruce Lyandike. His new book, Mighty Bad Land, A Perilous Expedition to Antarctica that reveals clues to an eighth continent called Zealandia, I find out. It's just been a fantastic read and a lot of curiosity about how people 30 years ago lived, six people in tents, canvas tents in Antarctica. So we had the team, which was five men and one woman, And then we had parts of the team that were trained in alpine survival. And, you know, even so, it was perilous many times. So here you are, you're doing commercial air to Christchurch, New Zealand, and you get outfitted with cold weather gear, military planes to McMurdo Station. You landed on the sea ice runway, and there you went into the deep field to do research and took ski-equipped U.S. Navy Hercules to the wilderness of the mountainous region called Marie Byrd Land. Describe for me, first of all, what were you fitted with? What was the cold weather gear you were fitted with? And I was thinking about this last night. It couldn't have been this thermal stuff Patagonia. You probably had some real woolen clothing, right? Tell me about the gear.
Sure. In the U.S. Antarctic program has a facility in Christchurch, New Zealand, where you get outfitted with what's called emergency cold weather gear, ECW. And, of course, we brought our own mountaineering gear also. Take a little bit different perspective on what you just said, Elizabeth. The key, and I think everybody knows this, to dealing with warm weather is layers. So you start with a layer right next to your skin, which is long johns, which would be made out of a material called capelline. And then on top of that, there'd be a fleece layer, which might be artificial fleece or wool fleece. Then on top of that would be a windbreaker. Then on top of that might be a vest. Then on top of that might be these very special parkas. We call them big reds because they're bright red. And they have 12 pockets. And these parkas are made in Canada. I forget the company that makes them right now. And, of course, they have a hood which can be extended into a tunnel for your face. And then if things get really nasty on your hands, you have a propylene glove liners, and then something like ski gloves. And over those gloves, you might have these things called bear paw mittens, which are big, clumsy, furry things. On your legs, you'll have the long johns, the fleece layer, and then wind pants. And on your feet, you'll have sock liners, and then one or two layers of socks. And then you'll be putting your feet into boot liners. And then the boot liners will go into mountaineering boots, which are hard plastic. So it's a lot of stuff.
Unbelievable. So did you ever change your clothes the whole time you were in the expedition?
Yes and no. First of all, space is important, both getting stuff out there, because you got to bring everything. I mean, if you need a paperclip, you got to bring it because there's no place to get it, and you're not getting resupplied. So you got to bring it, and then you got to fit the stuff in a tent or somewhere where it won't get blown away. So, the tent we lived in, they're called Scott Polar tents. They were designed at the beginning of the 20th century by the earlier, what's called the heroic explorers. They're 8 feet on a side with no floor, and they look like a pyramid. And they have four strong poles on each corner of 2 inches of thick wood. And then they have an inner liner, which gives you the illusion that there's an insulating layer between you and the outside, which doesn't really matter. I lost track of your original question because I got so...
Well, I wanted to know what the average temperature was in there. So we've got a mental picture.
Right.
Pretty cold. Okay, what? Give us a Fahrenheit reading.
Yeah. Okay, so in outside, it'd be about 20 degrees Fahrenheit, which is reasonably comfortable, except if there's any breeze. And anybody who's been in wind chill knows what that means, that, it hurts. Then inside the tent, we had a little one-burner stove for two people in a tent to start with. You have one-burner stove to melt snow to make water and then to cook your food. And so if you were cooking maybe for the entire day when there was a storm outside, you could get up to about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So you could get stripped down to your outer fleece layer. But I was never naked. Nobody's naked in there for any length of time. So we took what I did, and I think a lot of the rest of them did, was you wear your long johns for a week, then you turn them inside out, and you put them back on. So you get 2 weeks out of a pair of long johns, and then you had another pair of long johns to start over with. But obviously you're not doing any laundry. You're just rotating your clothes. It's also interesting to me that we really didn't have BO, you know, body odor. I mean, it's so cold that this, you know, bacteria are not growing there. That's besides the fact that I brought some stick deodorant and it was usually frozen and you couldn't use it anyway. So luckily we didn't have any BO in those close quarters. But yeah, you know.
Oh, well, just a few more questions about that is there's a section here that I want to read of you. You've been quoted here: living in a tent for weeks is a one day at a time experience. You must adjust to not going outside when a storm rages for days. And I want to ask about the storm cycle. You must always be clothed in layers, never naked. During a storm, you must find a way to spend idle hours. You read, snack, sleep, write in a small space, 8 by 8 feet. Two people per tent, each tent cooked on its own. We ate dehydrated food, canned frozen food, no fresh food. You didn't bathe, as we found out. For a toilet, we had a pee bottle. We emptied into a hole by the inside of the tent entrance. We had another pit outside for further bathroom needs behind a snow wall windbreak. We collected it. We collected feces in a gallon container, and we communicated with the 20-watt shortwave radio to McMurdo. Then the question I was going to ask before break. You were talking about the storms raging and what you're doing during the raging storm. How long are you talking about it? Is there any light? Is it a whiteout? What does a storm feel and look like?
Well, I mean, outside a tent versus inside a tent. Hopefully you're inside a tent when you're dealing with these blizzards, which can last anywhere from 2 days. On another expedition following this one, we had our blizzard lasted for 10 days where we were stuck in our tents. So usually what's going on, it's constant daylight, but you know, when the storm is blowing snow, there's no visibility, so it's overcast, so it's dim. You just learn to ratchet down your life, because you have to spend time either sleeping, and you can only do so much of that, except my tent mate managed to do it for 20 hours once, and reading and cooking stuff and cleaning up stuff, rewriting your scientific notes so you could read them at another time. And as you mentioned, we did cook on our own this first expedition, two people to a tent, but that turned out to be a little bit too isolating. And for this the second expedition the next year, we had a tent where we had called a kitchen tent, where we all gathered for meals and we could exchange notes and some camaraderie. That was very important. Being there, that was the most, made the most impression on me, was being alone. The aloneness of it is extraordinary. Even though there's six people with you, we were hundreds of miles away from anybody. And if when things were going good, we could get them up, raise them on a radio. But we weren't getting mail, and we weren't getting email. This is before the internet age. We didn't even have GPS. We didn't have walkie-talkies. So you're really, really alone. I want to give you an idea of what that means. I think our audience is...
Let me interrupt.
Okay,
go ahead. Richard's giving us a sign. We got to go to quick break. I'd love to know what it really means to be alone like that when we get back from the break. And the other question that I have for you is the cold and the lack of life in Antarctica. Since you're a geologist, I want to know what was that always the case? Did we always have a lifeless Antarctica? So those are the two questions I have. What's it like to be that alone? And then put your scientist hat on, if you would, Bruce, and tell us about this ancient place of Antarctica, Gondwana, the ancient name, and if it was always the way it is today. When we get back to the break, hey, Richard, let's go to quick break.
All right.
Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I have the pleasure of speaking with Bruce Lyon-Dyke. And Bruce had a really fantastic, life-changing experience 30 years ago. He was part of an expedition to Antarctica. And right before the break, we were talking about, I was interested to know what he did during the blizzards that could last 2 days to up to 10 days. And there you are, stuck in a tent. It's freezing. It's dark or it's not dark, depending, because it's always light, but you can't see because the snow is swirling. What you do, what you think about, how empty that must feel. And Bruce said, let me tell you what lonely is like. So go ahead, Bruce.
By the way, Bruce, before you answer her question, please don't lose your train of thought. Was it anything like being alone together during the COVID pandemic? Now, anything
close? Wow, that's interesting.
Anything close to that?
In other words, the idea of being sequestered.
Sequestered. And you chose to be sequestered.
Right. Actually, only slightly. I think this was much more extreme than what I experienced during COVID sequester and lockdowns, yeah. And let me give you a perspective on this from my point of view. Here's an analogy I tell people. We live in the Tri-Counties, so imagine you go down to the Santa Barbara Airport and you're going to fly to Denver. So you do that. You take off from the airport, then immediately, while you're even climbing the altitude, you see nothing but ice, snow, and rock below you. And then you're flying for a few hours over the same thing, ice, snow, rock. And then you end up in your, quote, Denver destination 800 miles later, and there's nothing there. Matter of fact, nobody's been there. So the pilots have to, first of all, create a safe landing spot. And they do that by a process called ski dragging, I can talk about that if you're interested in it. But anyway, you land there in the Hercules, and everybody's seen the Hercules, you know what they are. They have the tailgates drop down, and all the cargo goes shut it out the back through the tailgate. And there's nothing there. you're creating the there. So right away, after that plane flies away and all your stuff is there, you realize this is the most alone I think I've ever been, except in maybe in the middle of the ocean. But even there, there's ships around. And the aloneness becomes, for me, it became even heightened when things got stressful and even dangerous, like in extreme storms where you're worried about your tent blowing away. You know, then what? Or when we had an accident, so we had a crevasse accident, the rescue, you're alone. So you have to be, you got to be ready. So even though it took with the Hercules, 3.5 hours to fly us out to this nowhere spot, the weather is so challenging that in any given week, flying conditions are maybe only 2 days out of the week. So you're really not in a situation where you can get your paper clips that you forgot, or you can get immediately rescued by helicopters can't reach that far. And even the airborne fixed-wing Hercules, that's really questionable if they can just fire things up and come out and get you. So that's the aloneness. And then in sitting in a blizzard with a tent making rifle snaps in your ears and tent looking like it might lift up, which actually happened to friends of mine. So that makes you feel like you're alone, and anything that happens, you got to handle it.
I wanted to ask about this alone feeling. You obviously missed your family and friends, but I want actually to, I don't know if it's a difficult topic, but I want to talk about the crevasse accident. And there's a picture in the book of a hole in the snow where one of the team is shouting down to somebody who fell through that hole. And he was saved. But I want to talk a little bit about that accident just to kind of hammer home the self-sufficiency that one must have had, that you had, actually, Bruce. Maybe we'll talk about that, if that's okay, when we get back from the break. Hey, Richard.
Yes,
Elizabeth.
Let's go to a quick break, and then, maybe Bruce will tell us about the accident he's speaking about. This falling through the snow accident and the rescue that was occasioned. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. I'm speaking with Bruce Leyendyke, Mighty Bad Land, his story of a perilous expedition to Antarctica, a true story in which many interesting scientific discoveries were uncovered. And that's really the important part of the story, is this discovery of the eighth continent, Zealandia. True story, interesting and fascinating and well-written. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute with Bruce. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. It's my pleasure speaking with Bruce Leyendyke, his book, A Mighty Bad Land, his expedition to Antarctica. And Richard, I'll just show our listeners, if you are watching on video, this is Tucker shouting to Kimbrough. He fell through this split in the snow. And then, just so you're not too nervous, here is Dave Kimbrough, safe on the snowmobile after a rescue. That's from the book.
Now, by the way, they are sending a road crew up there to fill that slice in the snow in.
Oh, okay. Well, Bruce, I want you to tell me what happened? What happened to Kimbrough?
I saw Dave Kimbrough a few years ago, and then he sent me a picture last month where he was at March Madness in Houston with his wife. So he's living a good life. The crevasse accident, I don't want to say too much about it because it's a powerful message for me in the book, and I'd like folks to get a chance to read how it affected everybody. The fact is that Antarctica is a wondrous, enchanting, beguiling place full of this unexpected majesty, but it's also dangerous, and there's unseen menace everywhere. And these crevasses are cracks in glaciers. Glaciers, as they move, they crack, and they make these deep slices, wedge-shaped slices that go down sometimes hundreds of feet. And in Antarctica, they end up being bridged by snow, blowing snow. Snow blows across them, and eventually, over time, a gap, these long slices, the gap of maybe a few yards gets bridged over by this blowing snow. It just builds and builds and builds over time, and they're hidden, so you can't see them. So traveling around or over glaciers is always dangerous, and we thought we were prepared for it. We all, of course, had ropes, and we learned how to do rescue techniques for ourselves and others if we fell through these bridges. And I think we underestimated how many there were and how dangerous there were. And on this particular day, and I've heard other people say the same thing, Antarctic veterans, this particular day when the accident happened was just one of these gorgeous, beautiful days. It was one of those days where you forget all the miserable ones that you spent locked up in your tent, and you felt this giant relief. But what you also end up doing, if you're not really alert, is you let down your guard, and you feel reassured by the wonderful beauty around you. So I think that's what I mostly want to say, that we were trained well enough, but like everything else in the Antarctic, luck matters. And it was on our side that day.
Is there a renewed belief in God and faith in terms of those kinds of times when your mind starts to run away? And I guess going back maybe a little bit, and how do you have you trained your mind during those 6, 8, 10 days trapped inside your tent to keep the fear, keep the anxiety from overtaking you, like what you were just referring to?
Yeah, I wasn't that good at it. I was the leader, what they call the principal investigator. So I was responsible for everything, and that means you're accountable for everything. Mm-hmm. So whatever happens, for whatever reason, you're the leader. You're accountable. So, yeah, I was constantly worried about, is this a safe thing to do, and et cetera? Are we doing this correctly, et cetera? And we did have two mountain guides with us, one from Santa Barbara, by the way, Steve Tucker, the late Steve Tucker, who was a contractor here. But nevertheless, an accident's an accident.
Yeah. So did it go through your mind quite often, what the hell was I thinking?
Absolutely. Like, why did I put everybody in this circumstance?
Now, even though you're the captain of the proverbial ship, okay, as far as your level of responsibility, these people made the conscious decision on their own also to go on this expedition.
Exactly. They weren't naive.
Right.
I mean, anybody who thinks Antarctica is not dangerous should never go there.
Okay.
I want to go to quick break, but I think you bring up a really interesting point, and it was one on my list to ask Bruce about. So sometimes an experience, a place, an event in life match the demons in one's soul.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what I'm talking about,
yeah. Well,
because I know you.
Yeah. Well, my very first 3 days in Ireland, the first time I traveled abroad like that, I was out of my mind because we didn't really have a plan. We had no place to go after the third day. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to be living in our rental car, you know, once our hotel reservation ran out. I'm serious.
Well, no, but I'm talking about like the synchronicity of this, because and when Bruce's book opens, he's not in a good place.
No. I hear you.
And so he takes on this expedition, and during this expedition, you know, there's demons under the surface. And I took that crevasse accident as quite an example of the demons lurking under the surface. And, you know, it's a metaphor. Yeah. Any journey is a metaphor.
Yes.
On some deep level, you know. So I wonder if maybe we've got a few minutes after the break. Yep. I know that's a real heavy-duty topic, but I wonder if Bruce can just reflect on that. You know, there's two big themes, basically, that I can make out. Number one is this wonderful voyage of discovery. And the discovery happens because, of course, we're talking about a geologist's discovery of another continent.
Mm-hmm.
Huge issue.
Yep.
But there's other more personal journeys of discovery that are not as fortuitous.
Yeah. Well, let's have him address that following the break here.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. Bruce will just reflect on that a little bit. It's a very deep subject indeed. In a setting that is we would say both ensouled and soulless. Right. Okay, let's go to quick break. Welcome back. And, you know, in this short time we have left, and Richard was saying, gosh, this is such an interesting topic, and Bruce is such an interesting, deep person. We have to have you back, Bruce. Bruce Lyon-Dyke, we're talking about Mighty Badland. And just very quickly, Richard was very curious about this, and I am too, the demons that lurked underneath. So is there something that you felt about this, the synchronicity between your journey to Antarctica, your discovery, and what was going on in your life, Bruce?
Yeah, I think I got what I asked for. There's a quote from David Bowie that I lead off the book with, the musician. I want to read it. Because it's kind of sums up what has driven me as a scientist and explorer. And here's the quote: "Always go a little farther into the water than you feel you're capable of being in. Go a little bit out of your depth. And when you don't feel that your feet are quite touching the bottom, you're just about in the right place to do something exciting."
Wow.
So what he's talking about is find your envelope, find the edge of your envelope, and that'll pay off. That'll be paying off for you.
And Elizabeth was just showing that quote on the screen on the YouTube.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah. I think that's...
You know...
Go ahead.
I was going to say that is such an interesting reflection because it's so courageous. You know, the idea of just going right to the edge of what you think you're capable of. That's another thing about this, you know, the hero's journey that we're talking about in this book. And I just want to say there's the book is release date May 30th, Next Wednesday, not this week, but next Wednesday, there's a book signing at Chaucer's. You can meet the author, pick up a book and have it signed. And I didn't get a chance to read all the fantastic reviews that have come in and how it's gotten right to the top. Number one new release on Amazon. Fantastic. And thank you so much for being with us, Bruce. And you got to come back.
Oh, thanks so much, Elizabeth. Thanks, Richard.